The following program is a Zygon International audio presentation.
The latest incarnation of the Old Testament, one of the world's greatest works of war mythology, continues to unfold in the Middle East. One could also say Homer's Iliad has its contemporary counterpart in the conflict between Great Britain and Argentina over the Falklands Malvinas. The goddess reemerges in the women's movement. These are just a few examples of how myth continues to shape our daily existence. The mythology of love, the mythologies of war and peace, the inner journey, the hero's pathway, and so much more to be found in the human past are just as relevant in present now as we move towards the 21st century. As we become more aware of our own myths, so also will our life become richer and more fulfilling. This is our vision quest today with the world's foremost popularizer of mythology, Joseph Campbell. Once a world-class runner, Joseph Campbell is Professor Emeritus of Sarah Lawrence College. He is the author of The Hero with a Thousand Faces, The Mythic Image, and the classic four-volume The Masks of God. Join us for the next hour as we roam the mythic panorama, exploring our past and present with a visionary view to the future. My name is Michael Toms. I'll be your host. Joseph, welcome.
Thank you, Michael. It's always a real pleasure to be facing you across this table.
I'd like to dispel one of the myths about myths right at the beginning, and that is that we so often relate to myths as being fictitious, untrue, not real. What about that myth about myth?
Well, I can understand why that idea arose. Myths are metaphors. And if you mistake the metaphorical image for a reference to a fact, which is what has happened in the interpretation of myths frequently in religious traditions, and then find that this fact cannot ever have been a fact, you throw it out, and you lose then the reference along with the tenor of the reference.
If someone were to investigate mythology, what would be the best place to start?
Well, that's a fine question. You know, when I was giving a course in mythology, I gave one for some 35 years at Sarah Lawrence College, I had people start reading Ovid's Metamorphoses, because he's a marvelous storyteller. And the whole corpus of classical myth is there. And he clusters the stories according to type. So you begin to understand that there's a morphology, a form that can appear in various manifestations, various mythic tales. And the other part of it is that the order of the Ovid, starting in the beginning there with the beginning of the world, begins to follow the same pattern that the biblical tradition does, the biblical texts of Genesis. And from that you get the idea of comparing two totally different traditions. And then I turned my students over to Fraser's Golden Bough, the one-volume edition of Fraser's Golden Bough. His theories are, some of them now, a little bit old-fashioned, but nobody ever did a bigger job in pulling together things. And with that, you're in. And then I like to say that there's a little magazine being published in New York now, Parabola. And those young people working on that are doing a splendid job. So when people say to me, how do I get into the world of myth? this is not an advertisement. I say, subscribe to Parabola. Because you get people who are in the subject, understand it well, and giving you perspectives from various standpoints. And the references come out, and I think that's a good way to get in.
What about the presentation of mythic journeys through major films that have been very popular? I think of films like Star Wars, Excalibur, films like that where you have myth portrayed in an entertainment setting. What about that kind of presentation of myth? Do you think people get value from that?
Well, I'm told they do, but I haven't seen a movie for something like 15 years, and so I can't speak from my own experience and judgment. But I think the movie is a perfect medium for mythological messages. the medium is so plastic and pliable, and magical things can happen. And then the combination, you know, of fantastic landscape and possible modes of action and voyaging that we could hardly conceive of in good solid terms, you get mythological. I've often thought, for instance, that Wagner's Flying Hollander, the Flying Dutchman, would be a marvelous thing to render it as a mythic adventure. You know, you can pick up Wagner's music here and there, that wonderful scene where he has the living crew singing, and then the crew in the death ship, the spook crew, they sing as well. That's a mythological realm, and movies could handle this kind of thing.
Recently I talked with, I know, a friend of yours, Robert Bly, the poet.
Oh, that lovely man.
And Robert made a point which I thought was interesting. I don't know how much behind it he was, but he made a point that perhaps the presentation of these mythic ideas in popular films was almost like giving away the secrets, that somehow it wasn't appropriate, that maybe it wasn't appropriate to put it in this form, that somehow the real essence of it got lost in the presentation.
I can understand that point of view, and I can see what Robert's talking about. That's to say, you have not simply to look at a mythic development, but you have to participate in it. That's the sense of the ritual. What a ritual is an enactment of a myth, and by participating in the rite, you're participating in the mythic message. And myths don't count if they're just hitting your rational faculties. They have to hit the heart and then be absorbed, and you have to absorb them and adjust to them and make them your own life. And perhaps going from one movie to another like that, the thing's just passing too fast. See, people in a religious tradition live with that myth from infancy, and it builds in. And one mustn't mistake just picking up a story and then playing a role for absorbing a myth and making it the structuring form of your life.
It brings up the importance of ritual in life, and if one looks at this society, where do you see the important rituals?
Well, there's been an intentional destructuring of ritual in our society ever since the Puritan Revolution in the 17th century, you know. They cut out the rituals of the church, and then finally now the rituals of political and social life are being taken down. When I was a boy during the First World War, every time a regiment left for Europe, there was a magnificent parade. So people got their whole spirit into this terrific heroic action that was going on. And then in the Second World War, I can recall only one parade in New York, and that was on a returned regiment. It was an impressive affair, but it wasn't, the people weren't in it. And then, of course, with the Vietnam War, the other tribe, the one that were against the war, was the ones that were putting on all the rites, and they won, you might say. Look at a picture in the movies of President Wilson meeting people. He has a high hat. And then presidents after that had just felt hats. And then we have the good fellow well-met president, you know. And this is a reduction, so that one gets a sense rather of a personality than of a man in a role representing a mode of consciousness that's that of the nation.
That could explain much of the rebellion and resistance that we have to authority in our society.
I know it. That's what it is. Well, add to that the combination of Marx and Freud, and you have dynamite for young people, because Marx tells you about the exploiter and the exploited, and then Freud tells you your father's the exploiter, and then you unite father with the nation, and you get what we had in the 60s. It's rather bad. But I always think of that funeral of President John Kennedy as having been a resurrection of the power of ritual. The nation was struck down, you might say, by that horrifying event, and you got the feeling that this was a nation that had a purpose and had an ideal and pulled together. It was a great, great affair.
That was a powerful experience.
And it was a ritualistic event that gun carriage, you know, and those were all traditional forms. The six horses and then the one at the side with the reverse stirrups, those are old Indo-European themes. The six horses are the horses of the various spheres of the planet, and the soul was being carried back through the spheres to the high end and beginning. It's a beautiful affair.
Yeah, I recall it as a powerful experience in my own life. I listened to it on the radio because I didn't have a television.
Mm-hmm.
And within a few months after that event, I found myself leaving the East Coast and moving to California. I'm not sure how much that event had to do with it, but certainly it had something to do with it.
Yeah. Well, things well rendered that way. It's an effective art. Art is our medium now, but not many artists realize what the medium is that they're handling, you know, how deeply important it is.
Joseph, that little piece of music we were just listening to is from the movie Chariots of Fire.
Oh, yes.
Produced and composed that music by Vangelis in England. And 1924 was the year, and it was the time for the Olympics. And that was a time when you were unfolding your journey, wasn't it?
Yes. Well, I actually was in Paris at that time, and I saw every one of those events in that 1924 Olympics. And I had just started my own running career. It developed in the next 3 years. And at the end of that, then I went to Europe again as a student. And so I was between those two Olympics, 24, which was in Paris, and 28, which was in Amsterdam. Well, I just only 2 days ago, or yesterday actually it was, saw the film on the airplane as I was coming across the continent. But I didn't have earphones. I was interested in following the plot. And it was nice to see those beautiful people running down the track again. The event that I saw there that I thought was most convincing and looked to me most like a real athletic event was the high hurdle thing. That's such a beautiful event. And those boys look good going over those hurdles.
The Olympics is an example of a ritual, isn't it?
Well, it started as a ritual in Greece long, long ago. And you know when you go to Delphi, I don't know whether you've been there.
No, not in this
you
lifetime.
You really get the sense of the Greek ideal. At Delphi, there was the oracle. At Delphi, and there's the unconscious, the depth speaking to you, telling you the truths. And then there are the beautiful temples, just glorious, the Greek physical beauty of those things. You want to go up and just put your hand on the glorious buildings. And next, we have the theater. And these are all associated with the religious experience, do you see? And then at the top level is the stadium, where any young man of Greece who could run a good 180 yards was eligible, you know? And the idea of the total man, it's a beautiful idea. And the Greeks represent it in a way that no other culture, as far as I know, ever did. We have athletics and all of that in other traditional cultures, but usually, traditionally, it was associated with the governing caste, the warrior caste, and so forth. And here was the idea of a total man. I guess the Greeks were the first that got the idea of man instead of man of a special race or a special career, you know, or social position. The idea of man.
What do you think of the contemporary version of the Olympics? You think it still represents that total man?
Well, I think the thing broke up when the Hitler Olympics, because he made a political event out of it. And also there was that ugly thing of not Hitler not awarding the medals personally to the black people. And now we have, I think the whole thing's been thrown off by the Russian and East European attitudes, because those young men and women are really professionals. The country is taking care of them, and they're specialists in this thing, and that's a totally different thing. I remember the 1924 Olympics. Our best walker, his name was Willie Plank, couldn't go to the Olympics because he had a family to support. I mean, that's the real amateur, do you see? In those days, if we accepted a railroad ticket to go someplace, we were professionals. Now, you have our young men and women facing these pros, and of course, my God, it's pushed the records way, way down. It's fantastic what people are doing now. But that's another kind of ideal.
You mentioned the Delphic Oracle, and it just occurs to me how seemingly out of touch we are with that inner part of ourselves and that visionary part of ourselves. We live in a society that's heavily oriented to technology and an industrial age, the nuclear age. What about that aspect of what have we lost in losing that contact with that inner self?
Well, I think that people are now recovering it, at least those that I know are, but the nation isn't recovering it. You see, the wonderful thing about the Delphic Oracle was governors and princes would go and ask the oracle how to handle political affairs, and the advice from those centers isn't coming into us now, as far as I know. We lost touch generally. People feel rootless because they have lost touch with those depths in their lives and in our nation. Our nation is run really by economics and politics. I find no spiritual goal anymore. I mean, actually functioning in the making the decision of the state. It's all economics and politics.
How do you think that happened?
Well, it's a hard thing to try to date, but one is the loss of confidence. I think this whole third world recognition that the people that we were smashing and knocking down have values and rights, and ought to have rights at any rate, of their own, and a kind of shame at what we've done and what we're inevitably doing. But this is an inevitable consequence of the last imperialistic stage of a culture. Rome faced the same thing. Virgil deals with this. And Goethe foresaw it in the Faust, in the last act of part two of Faust. He's in this period where ground-rooted people are uprooted and thrown aside so that housing developments could be built and all that kind of thing, you know. Struck me very strongly in Egypt when I was up at Aswan. There was this dam that was built, and the water backed up and wiped out the whole province of Nubia. So what happened to the Nubians? They were moved out of there and put in housing developments. Read Faust, Act 5, that's exactly what is happening there. And so there's a kind of inevitability about it. Nobody's to blame. The culture moves from a deep spiritual impulse, a lyric moment that creates the forms of the culture, you might say, but then more and more practical life comes in. Well, I find it in my own personal life. As I grow older, more and more economic and political details are pushing in, and I wonder where that early quietness was inside, you know, that made it possible to move out of your own center. Your own center somehow goes out. And this is just perhaps an organic process of moving from the lyric of childhood into the practical problems of later life.
We have the institution, as you mentioned, being without spiritual values.
Yeah.
And at the same time, we have movements emerging in the society. The ecology movement, the women's movement, equal rights movement, nuclear movement, all with seemingly a greater sense of human values, spiritual values. What do those movements represent in relationship to the institutions that seemingly are in decay?
Well, what's happened to the institutions is that they have become kind of self-interested, you might say, and not in service to a national impulse. And so people break off, and you find this, that, or the other spiritual aim, but they don't coordinate into something that's supporting the whole. And they become revolutionary and, in a sense, or really destructive in a certain sense. But you, as they used to say, you know, you can't make an omelet without breaking eggs. The old things are falling apart and new things coming out. And you may be getting just inklings here, there, and twinkling around of some great fire that finally is going to have a positive creative power about it. Now there, for example, the realization that the women's movement represents of women in new roles. The old roles were those of a relationship to the male who was related to the structuring of the society. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes.
The woman was cooperating, and she was what the society was being put together for, so that she should bring forth the next generation in a decent way. Well, look what's happened to the family. I understand that something like one marriage out of 10 survives in this country, and as a result, the children are dislocated. It's a terrible situation of an ideal for life just completely knocked to pieces.
Some people would say this is the death of the patriarchal institution and the emergence of the matriarchal. What do you think?
Well, I don't think there ever was a matriarchal. We can't locate it in time and space. But you mustn't mistake the period when the mother goddess was a dominant power in the Neolithic and Bronze Age, because people were related primarily to agriculture, and she is the producing earth, and then the power of women and the power of the earth is the same power. Then you have invasions from north and south, with the Indo-Europeans and the Semitic people coming in, warrior people, herding people, not linked in the same way to production. And this war period takes over. The third and second millenniums B.C. are just incredible, the battle fury of those days. Well, you get the echoes of it in the Book of Judges and the Book of Joshua. My God, what stories of annihilating cities.
One battle after another.
And no more than that, I mean, annihilating everybody in the city. And that's the way it went on. And with that, the women have to be protected from these invading warrior people, and so the male pattern takes over. And then the religions that came out of that, particularly the biblical religion, which is a very strongly male-oriented religion. Christianity picked it up, Islam picked it up. Now we're moving into another province.
Do you think war is endemic to humanity?
Yes. The raids of one primitive village against another, that's one thing. But the business of conquest and appropriating other people's property and towns, you know, with a sense of righteousness in doing so, that begins, as far as I know, in the Near East in the third millennium B.C., about the time of Sargon I, 2750 B.C., something like that.
Are there any cultures that have a mythology of peace as contrasted with a mythology of war?
Well, the mythology of peace comes along in such doctrines as those of Christ or Lao Tzu or Confucius or the Buddha and so forth, but those are not what dominate the culture. Spengler has a statement in The Decline of the West which stays in my mind. If you haven't the courage to be the hammer, you'll come off in the role of the anvil. And that's just ABCs of political life.
Joseph, when we look at history and we look at mythology and we see that war has been with humanity down through the ages, and yet at the same time, when one looks at those early times, one senses that there was a ritualistic aspect to conflict, that there was an understanding. It was almost as if the conflict had some kind of controls and parameters around it. Now we live in an age which seemingly is out of control. Certainly the weapons are really out of control, the nuclear proliferation. What about that aspect of here we are, if indeed the mythology of war is endemic, somehow we've lost the ritual of conflict, if that had any value at all?
Well, when one thinks of Europe, for instance, in the 17th and 18th centuries, the conduct of war was a function of a certain class of society. And it was an aristocratic activity and didn't smash up the cities and people the way these modern wars do. Everything changed with Napoleon, where you had a mass army raging over Europe. That was a new phenomenon. and war changed its character at that time, and that's the way it's been ever since, that we are all subject to the draft when the time comes, you know? The citizen stops being a citizen and turns into a warrior. In the earlier centuries, it was a special type of person that was trained for this, and it wasn't just a person who had, day before yesterday, learned that he was a soldier. I think that another example of that kind of thing is with Alexander the Great. When he went across Persia into India, there was a new seriousness and ruthlessness in the war as he conducted it that was very much like the kinds of things we're having now. Earlier, it was the people of the Kshatriya caste. And when you read of the Greek siege of Troy, the people who went from Greece were special aristocrats, you might say, and it was an aristocrat war. Of course, when the city fell, then that was that. The city was taken, and the people were in bad shape, just as they were in the Book of Judges. But the conduct of war was not a conduct for everybody to participate in. And now, of course, with these airplanes and bombs and rockets and so forth, and now with the terrific annihilation of an atom bomb, that whole thing has moved out of hand.
What about that fascination that humanity has always had with death, and the symbol of death and destruction in our age now is a mushroom cloud? And what about that symbol? It's almost as if we're propelled to move into the mystery of death, and perhaps that's part of our seemingly programmed continuation of building more and more bombs.
Well, there's a rather amusing, if one can use that word in this kind of side to this thing. You know, Christianity was born in a period when the Hebrews thought the world was going to end. There was the apocalyptic idea, and we have the Dead Sea Scrolls to let us know that exactly at that time, just the first centuries B.C. and A.D., there was in the Hebrew world the notion that there was going to be the end of the whole universe. And the people of the Qumran community there on the Dead Sea were preparing themselves to be the ones that carry on the spark of light because of their virtue when the whole nasty world is wiped out. Then you had the idea, and this, I think this comes finally from Zoroastrianism, that there is a kind of rhythm, and that the world is going to end. And we have the idea of the millennium, the end. So when the year 1000 was coming, there was this kind of hysteria also that the world's going to end. And a lot of people in Europe, I'm told, gave their property to the church so that they'd gain merit in heaven. And then when the world didn't end, they're still trying to get those properties back. Now we come to the year 2000, everybody thinks it's all going to end again. Now we've got the atom bomb to give a kind of reality to this expectation. But there's something strange about this this idea that every 1,000 years there's going to be an end. I remember reading in the New York paper one day the story of a man who was building a grandstand somewhere in Ohio and selling tickets to see the end of the world. Now, with respect to death, of course, death is life. If we weren't dying, we wouldn't be living. And we think more of the life than of the death side, and so compulsively, I suppose, the psyche is telling us, look, think about this. This is your death is part of your life, and we think about it in a negative way, but you think of it in a positive way, too.
There's this paradox that somehow we've cheapened death. I mean, we can come up with terms like mega-deaths, which is a cheapening of life. And also a failing to confront death.
Yes.
And so there's this paradox constantly operating.
And things that you consciously don't integrate into your thinking, they come with a compulsive threatening quality when you do put your mind to them. So there is this very morbid contemplation of death. I notice in young people now, what's the use of living because the atom bomb may explode, you know? They just lose the impulse to shape a life course.
Well, we've lost some of our vision, haven't we?
I think we've lost it all.
Why do you think that?
Well, I don't know. I don't see any intention anywhere in our public action. Another word of Spengler, some long time ago, he wrote a work called The Years of the Decision, Yarede and Scheidung, and he was dealing with exactly these years that we're in, and he spoke about France and Germany and so forth and the different nations. And when he came to the United States, he had only two sentences, he said. A cluster of dollar trappers, no past, no future. And when you add to that Lenin's brilliant statement, when we communists get ready to hang the capitalists, they'll compete to sell us the rope, and then look at what's going on. That's not comfortable.
Do you see any reason for hope in some of the new movements that have emerged in America over the last 10 years or so?
Yes, I do. I've been lecturing a great deal since I retired about 11, 12 years ago from my college teaching, and I meet beautiful people and come into context of great hope and expectation. And, you know, I think the rule for life when the world seems to be going apart is to stick to your own trajectory. Hang on to your own ideas and ideals and find the people who are hanging on too. And it's that new life that survives the mega death, you know? I think so.
So there's something on the other side of the darkness.
Yeah, well, Spengler, I'm quoting Spengler now because you brought this thing in of war and death and the culture. He has an image of the ideal when all's going apart. He says the image that he has in his mind is the soldier in Pompeii who stayed right at his post when the volcanic ash was coming down, you know. Even at the worst moment, if you're holding on to your trajectory, you've won. It's the one who gets thrown off his track who's lost.
Joseph, this loss of vision or loss of focus, as it were, perhaps it may be the effect of a world that is much smaller than it once was, in the sense that we literally know what's going on the other side of the planet within seconds of it happening. And there's cultures are breaking down, in the sense of nations breaking down, that no longer are the national boundaries as rigid as they once were.
Well, Michael, I think you named the real crux of the problem. Every mythology, and a mythology is an organizing system that holds a culture together, grew up within a bounded horizon of people who were having similar experiences and with similar intentions in their lives. And now all these bounding horizons are broken. When I was a boy, we never saw in the United States a Hindu. I never saw a Hindu. Today, you know, 30 hours you can be in India. And it's a normal thing on our campuses to see young people from the Orient. And so ideas are coming pouring back and forth into the various cultures that had never been operative in their lives before. And so there's that scatter. Now, a mythology deals with, among other things, a culture context. One of its functions is to validate and maintain a certain culture system. And these cultures are in transformation within themselves, but at the same time meeting other cultures. And you can ask yourself, what is my society? What is my in-group? Then you know your myth. Well, the only society, the only in-group that's proper for today is the planet, it seems to me. And this is an enormous challenge to open up that way, give not only yourself but also your culture to the planetary view. And you see people pulling back into in-groups all over the place. And of course, each in-group has a long tradition to support its point of view. And we don't have a universal social image yet.
When we look at history, do we see historical examples or mythological examples of where an existing culture has broken down and a new culture has emerged that we could compare ourselves to?
Well, you can see, for instance, the Roman world, that was an equivalent time, and the Roman world covered an enormous territory and incorporated a great many types of people in the one culture, then disintegrated as these different types took over, and you have in the south, the Islam comes out of that same domain, and in the north, the European culture world, and then in the northeast, what now is turning out to be the Russian was beginning to come through. So it was disintegrating. But I think what's happening here is just the opposite, that all these cultures are pouring into one great domain and having a hard time. The one that seems to me to be handling the thing in the most successful way is Japan. I've been over there a couple of times, three times now, and I'm tremendously impressed. The maintaining of the ideas and culture structuring principles of the old Japanese tradition, and at the same time absorbing the Occidental gift and then adapting it and operating with the same integrity that was there before in this new context. It's to me fascinating. I don't know any culture that's done as well.
One of the aspects of this cultural change or breakdown, as the case may be, is the changing and lessening of the strength of religious institutions as we've known them, particularly in Western culture. What do you see the significance of that? And at the same time, we seem to have a re-emerging interest in spirituality, if you want to pay attention to some of the Gallup and Harris polls.
Well, that's a very delicate and a sensitive question. You see, the imagery and religious life of the West has been maintained by certain institutions. And, for instance, when you have a College of Cardinals telling you what you must believe and establishing the mythology to which everybody had to conform, and then when there's a break from that mythology, but it again moves into an institutional thing. Meanwhile, people are experiencing life in ways that are not those that the officers of the institution understand. And so you have a split in Western consciousness, and it becomes tremendously powerful and important around the 16th and 17th centuries. I think the churches just lost their grip on the dynamics of European life at that time. And now they're trying to move in again. But what I see in America is one of the strongest religious movements or quests in our history. The churches are empty. On the other hand, I was in Boston and lecturing with Robert Bly a couple of days ago, and right next door was Billy Graham, and he had an enormous public. So I don't think one can say that great masses of people in this country, the traditional religious things are lost at all. I mean, you get a man with the power and the charisma who can deliver it, and he does, and they respond. So there is that. But I don't know. I've never heard Billy Graham, and I don't know what he does with the message. But people are in quest all over the place now. The great thing that I think the Oriental teachers have done is to say the real mystery of religion is within you. The main thing is not what happened 2,000 years ago somewhere else, but what is happening in you now. And this is a Christian mystic idea also. For instance, there's a wonderful little mystic named Angelus Silesius. I always think of him as a little man because he rendered his message in very short two-line verses. And one is as follows: of what use, Gabriel, your message to Marie, unless you can now give the same message to me, namely, that the Christ should be born in me. And if it's not born in you, well, then the religion hasn't worked. And whether you call it the Christ or the Buddha or cosmic consciousness or whatever, It's the one message that these different religions are delivering, and unless one reads them in terms of an inner life, I think one has lost one's own ground and base.
Well, if we look at our own culture as a Judeo-Christian culture and we go back to Christ, and we certainly he was a teacher of the experience. He wasn't just imparting information. He was speaking from his own experience, and he was really dealing at that level. And somehow the tradition lost that experiential aspect, and it turned into basically the College of Cardinals telling you what to do.
Exactly. And there were varieties of Christianity before the crisis in the 4th century, when Theodosius said, you know, there's not to be any religion in the Roman Empire but the Christian, and no variety of Christianity but that of the Byzantine throne. Up to that time, there were a number of Christianities, and now they're being rediscovered with the digging up of manuscripts. And one of the most interesting, I think, is what's come to light with the Gospel according to Thomas, where the words are put in the mouth of Christ, or perhaps they came out of the mouth of Christ. We don't know about these Gospels, how much they really reproduce what was actually said. But here Jesus says, he who drinks of my mouth will become as I am, and I am he. Now that's Gnosticism, that's Buddhism. We're all Buddha beings. We're all Christ beings. And the difference between you and me and the Buddha is that he knew how to live in terms of Buddha consciousness instead of his own little individual interests. And living in Christ is the comparable thing using the Christian terminology. It's fascinating to compare the language of Christian and Buddhist teachings. And when you realize that gnosis is the Greek word for bodhi or Buddhism, and then read back and forth, Meister Eckhart's another who speaks almost the language of the Buddha. It's in a comparative way that one can learn from another tradition to see an aspect of one's own that one had not been paying attention to, and a kind of a little illumination goes up, particularly since our tradition has been institutionally dominated, you know? And now comes the personal experience aspect, which the Orient knows how to teach to us.
There may even have been an historical interchange between the Buddhist and the early Christians.
I'm completely convinced that there was. There's an exhibition in New York right now of the art of the Silk Route from Aleppo to Chang'an in China. And there were Nestorian Christian, Manichaean, Buddhist chapels and temples all along that route. Furthermore, the distance between the centers in the West and the East were not great, and there were traffic back and forth. There were delegations from Kushana, India, to Rome, and vice versa. Ashoka, in the 3rd century BC, the great Buddhist monarch of India, sent missionaries to Alexandria. And when you realize that Alexandria was one of the centers from which Christianity took its theology, you realize this inevitably was a relationship. And I see the Christ, when you look at the doctrine of the Christ from the standpoint of a Buddhist, the Christ is a bodhisattva, the one who comes with love to the world to participate in the sorrows of the world gladly. You know, that wonderful saying in the epistle to the Philippians of Paul, for Christ did not think godhood something to be clung to, but let go and took incarnation as man, even as the servant of man, and to death on the cross. That's bodhisattva stuff. Joyful participation in the sorrows of the world. And I think of the crucifix, too much has been made of the suffering of Jesus. There's another kind of crucifix, which is called Christ triumphant, where he's there, eyes open, and Augustine says Christ went to the cross as a bridegroom to his bride. And there is the imitation of Christ moving into life with that zeal for it, where suffering is only part of what life is. All life is suffering, but you're moving on a dimension that's not worried about that so much as about the fulfillment of a spiritual dynamic.
That kind of brings me to a natural next question, and that is the relationship of that inward journey, that inner search, and the vision quest, that outward hero's journey? What is that? What is the connection between the inward and the outward?
Well, the outward, this depends on whether you're on an economic quest, you know, or a spiritual quest.
Spiritual.
But the spiritual quest is always realized through relationships, and those are outward. And what you're seeking is the relationship that opens up dimensions within yourself that are greater than those that you knew when you started. I think it's, Jung says somewhere, the only way to spiritual fulfillment is through relationships.
Well, Joseph, our relationship in these conversations has always been richly rewarded.
I always go away better man than I was when I came.
I always feel like I'm walking down a path with an extraordinary guide, and I can just ask questions about what I don't quite understand, and I'll get the answers.
Well, the great art of spiritual development is asking the right questions, and so you help me with yours. Thank you, Michael.
I've been speaking with Joseph Campbell, author of The Mythic Image, The Masks of God, Hero with a Thousand Faces. My name is Michael Toms. I'm wishing you well.